Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, April 15th, 2008 Carrboro Board of Aldermen regular business meeting. We will begin our agenda with requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. So I would like to, the only person I have is Ellen Perry. Ellen, if you would come on up.
As far as I can. Hi, guys.
Hello.
How are you all?
Good.
I had a fun day today. Guess what happened? The ramp at Carmel Mall was blocked. It was blocked by they're redoing the Townsend and Brookson roof, and I called Nathan as soon as I found out. And Nathan said, "Do you need to get in?" I said, "Yeah, of course I'm going to Elmo's." Why? It's just Nathan does not get it. When I want to go someplace, I go. And a little court is not going to happen. You know, a little court's not going to stop me. So he sent James looking at for me. James is the security guard. I waited for about 5 minutes there. Finally, somebody else came by and let me in. And it was somebody that worked at Carmel Mall, Weaver Street. But it wasn't fair. Any business that's going to have work done on their roof, or any business that's going to have work done around town, needs to make sure that people can get around. People as trollers go up now that ramp. People, wheelchairs, people, everybody go up and down. I mean, that ramp. And it's just ridiculous. So I don't know what we can do about it. But I did. I went up to Mark, told him about it. Mark did not understand what I was talking about until tonight, right now. Mm-hmm. Then I came up to Roy. And got him. I told him about it, and he was going to have Mike DeNova look at it. And they blocked off two accessible parking spots.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought this to our attention, Ellen. Thank you for coming out tonight. I think probably the thing to do is to, if the board is willing, is to direct the manager and through him the inspection staff to look into the situation and take necessary steps to ensure that people with disabilities have adequate access to the facility and that make sure that they're in compliance with their permit with regard to the accessible parking situation at Carmel Mall.
Even when they're doing renovations, that's no excuse.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ellen.
Thanks, Ellen.
So I take that as a motion from
Absolutely.
Jackie
yeah.
and a second from Randy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thanks.
Ellen. You're a pretty good self-advocate too, Ellen.
It's true.
That's what my business is going to be.
That's true.
All right. You know you love your independence.
Okay. The second thing that I would like to turn to on our agenda is, it's actually not on our printed agenda, but I hope the board will forgive me. I took the liberty on Friday of asking the OWASA staff to come to this meeting to discuss with us a little bit the change in water shortage stage from stage three to stage one. That was a decision that was made by the OWASA board this past week, and to update us on what the situation is with our water supply. I've been asked to sign a proclamation making that official for the town of Carrboro, and I, given the immediate circumstance, that I would like to hear a report from WASA and get some, receive some input from the members of this board before taking that step.
Good evening. Ed Kerwin, WASA Executive Director. Also want to make sure you know that WASA board member and Carrboro appointee Braxton Pusci is here, and also Ed Holland, the WASA Planning Director. The headlines is water storage is significantly better than it was, well, just 2 weeks ago when I visited with you last. We're up to a little over 70% full now, and the WASA board at their meeting last Thursday evening rescinded Stage 3 water shortage and declared a Stage 1 water shortage. As I think you know, we developed several years ago, and after the drought of 2001-2002, a risk-based model that was one of the tools that would guide us in making decisions about various levels of water shortage. And we understood that that was guidance that the WASA board and staff would also consider other factors important at the time. And in fact, last October, October 18th, when the WASA board declared a Stage 2 shortage, our risk model suggested we only need to be in an advisory level at that time. But the WASA board, at staff's recommendation, adopted a very progressive Stage 2 level of restrictions because our lakes were full in May, and by October they had dropped dramatically because of just extraordinarily dry weather. Other factors our board considered was our neighbors were in similarly bad or even worse shape quickly over the summer, and perhaps most concerning at the time was the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration forecasted the drought to persist. So our board, I believe, has a track record of being very conservative and aggressive with conservation measures. On March 1st, Stage 3 took effect, and our risk model suggested we only needed to be in level Stage 1. But again, we were at only 40% of our capacity. We hadn't seen the reservoirs begin to refill over the winter, and forecasts still was that the drought may persist. Last Thursday evening, the board suggested and took action to relax it to Stage 1. Again, if you look at our risk model, we would only be an advisory level. But what's important, that even though the board took this level, understanding risk is much lower, the drought is not over, and we still need people to use water very wisely. And the WASA customers have just done, particularly over the last 2 or 3 months, an outstanding job. And I always have high expectations for people, myself included, and I expected a lot from the WASA customers, and they have exceeded our expectations, frankly. So we just can't thank everyone who's made sacrifices enough. But as I said, the drought's not over. We need people to stick with it. You've seen this many times, but I want to use this to answer the question. University Lake has been full for a month, but Cane Creek is not. Why? You can see that the watershed area is about the same size, about 30 square miles each, but Cane Creek holds 6 times more water than University Lake. So the University Lake bucket naturally fills much quicker than the Cane Creek bucket. Here's a shot of a full University Lake on Monday, a full Corey Reservoir. And on the right-hand side, I'll just point out that this is a new structure. This is our pump station that was completed last year, where we now can pump water directly from the Corey Reservoir, if it's needed, to our water plant here in Carrboro. And then last but certainly not least is the Cane Creek Reservoir, still 7.5 feet below full. The utilities have adopted a common measurement of how much water is left. And this is not a forecast, but this is if you assume that the demand of the last 30 days, if that continued, and how much water you have in your lakes or reservoirs, how long would that last if it didn't rain?
Excuse me. I have a question about that, because it seems to me that if you're going to Stage 1, you have to presume a significantly higher level than the last 30 days.
Well, I'm trying to explain. This is not a forecast.
You're going to get to that?
Yes, I absolutely will. This is not a forecast. This calculation just allows an apples-to-apples comparison of utilities that their relative condition with respect to supply. Certainly our demand the next 30 days, as things get warmer, we expect to naturally sell more water. So this is not saying we have exactly 403 days left. What this is saying, comparing ourselves to our utility neighbors, all using the same criteria, if demand continued, or assuming the average of the last 30 days and what's in your buckets right now, how long would it last without rainfall? So this is not a forecast, but this is to say, even at 70% capacity, as far as water on hand, we measure up quite well. And even under stage one, those restrictions in most cases are even more strict than our neighbors who have less supply. Did that address?
Yes, thank you.
I have a question that only a non-scientist could ask that's been floating around our dinner table lately. In the summer, when it's really hot and when it's really dry, I'm presuming that we're losing a lot more water to evaporation.
We are.
During that. I was right. So would that kind of figure into how we're projecting?
Again, this is not a projection of supply.
No, I mean, but later
but
on
we
as
look
we go.
Forward, we do factor in how much water we would expect to pump in each month. And it is higher in the summer than it is in the winter.
So given that our summers have been significantly hotter, I mean, our winters have been significantly warmer too, but that our summers have been significantly hotter and the air has been significantly drier, that means that not only we're losing more water to grass, but we're losing more water to the air, right?
Perhaps,
Ed, I had a question on that last slide. The one thing that I don't, when I look at something like this chart, that I don't see that I think is important, or I consider important in my thinking, is that Owassa has about 60 miles of recharge area, whereas Durham, Raleigh, and Cary have a much larger recharge area. Is that so? I mean, isn't that...
Well, it's a ratio of the drainage area to the size of their reservoir. I mean, Falls Lake, I don't know. Ed Holland, do you know off the top of your head how much water Falls Lake holds?
It's got a drainage area of 740 miles.
And Jordan Lake has a drainage area of almost 1,800 square miles. But off the top of my head, I don't know.
See, that's
much,
where...
But our Cane Creek Reservoir was, you know, it was put in service in 1989, so it's relatively new. And it was sized really at its maximum. What, practically, how large could you make the Cane Creek Reservoir without just building it just ridiculously too large? So,
but I'm thinking of it in terms of what it takes to recharge, and that's why, you know, Raleigh and Durham filled so much more quickly earlier.
That's right. The ratio of their watershed to the size of their lake or their pot is different than ours.
Right.
And it was our experience after the drought of 2001-2002 that King Creek was one of the last, if not the last, area reservoir to fill. Absolutely. Again, this is something you've seen many times. The key point, though, since King Creek went online in 1989, at 70% full on April 14th, this is still the lowest we've been this time of year. So while you see significant improvement over the last 5 or 6 weeks, you know, truly blessed that we've gotten this kind of rain, we're still the lowest we've ever been this time of year. So even though our risk model says at this level in April, in 82 years of history, we would never run out of water based on history in the next 18 months or below our 20% trigger, it still concerns us that we're at a historically low level. And so that's why the board really wants to emphasize we're still in a drought, we still need people to use water wisely, and it's something we have to watch very carefully. Something else that we can be proud of as a community is we're pumping over 30% less water this April than in April 2002. In April 2002, we didn't have restrictions in place, But we also didn't have year-round conservation measures, something that this board in Chapel Hill and Orange County adopted in 2003 as part of lessons learned. So we went to year-round conservation, drought or no drought, and we have a much more stringent level of mandatory restrictions when there's a shortage. So the actions you took are a part of this. Certainly the actions our customers have taken to greatly reduce their demand, and I have a slide on that in a minute, is an important part of that. In Owosso, we've also reduced by around 8% the amount of water we had to pull out of our lakes for a process purpose at the water plant next door. So that's been an important improvement, too. So here's the customer demand. Again, I know you've seen this several times. The important numbers is the green line was our projected how much water we would sell, you know, this time last year when we were making a forecast without a drought. And the red line is the different goal levels depending on what level of mandatory restrictions we were under. And you can see that essentially since February, our customers have met the and exceeded our conservation goals, including conserving more than 20% while we were at stage three. So again, that is really significant. We also expect, as was our experience after the drought of 2001-2002, even when restrictions are relaxed, that these new learned habits of our customers will continue, that we won't see a quick rebound to pre-drought consumption levels. We know our customers now have reset the bar, and over the long haul, that's a good thing. And I think I probably covered these key things. So the Owosso Board last Thursday, you know, took the action to reduce because the risk of depletion was much diminished. NOAA is now forecasting, and this is how weather people, I guess, put it, that there's a 50-50 chance of normal rainfall over the next 2 or 3 months. But the forecast is for improvement in rainfall back to more normal levels. And something else that we have now that...
I thought you said that the 400-plus days wasn't a forecast.
It's not. That's what we have currently using that convention that all the utilities have agreed to use. So, no, that is not a forecast of how much water. I have a slide
that... So it's 400 days, but it's not actual days. It's like a day in some kind of...
Yeah, I have some slides that might address that. Something else that we have now that we didn't have 6 months ago is a worst-case response plan. And it's unlikely we would need it, and it's certainly not desirable, and it's very expensive. But when the Owosso Board years ago established we don't want to drop below 20%, a large part of that thinking was because we had no idea what we would do to keep us from running out of water. Now we do have an idea of what we do. We have a plan of what we would do. This addresses more of the projection now because this is assuming we start May at around 70% full, and that red line is now without rainfall. And it's a band because we're assuming, as high as 9 MGD or as low as 7 MGD. But this is not 400 days. This is something less than that because it factors in each month how much demand we would expect our customers to use that time of year. So this is a forecast without rainfall, how long would our supplies last. And as you know, we've used this model saying, let's look at the worst 3 years and 82 years of record. And if that rainfall and that stream flow repeated itself, during the coming year, how low would our lakes get? And you see in all of those droughts, they drop fairly measurably over the year, but in no case do we bottom out or get less than 10% of our supply. Stage one restrictions, just as a reminder, it would limit spray irrigation or does limit spray irrigation to only 1 day a week and during the hours of 8 p.m. and 9 a.m., even address Tuesday, I'd address Thursday. And all irrigation, no matter how it's applied, is limited to 1/2 inch a week. It does allow empty pools to be filled or operating pools to be topped off. Car washes is allowed. And we still have surcharges built into our rates under stage one. As I said, we expect, even with relaxing the restrictions, that customer demand will not jump back to pre-drought conditions. It'll stay lower because of conservation ethics of our customers. Clearly, it's something we need to monitor closely. Chair Jacobs, you know, signed the proclamation on Friday. Mayor Foy, after the meeting last night, indicated his intention to sign it. But we also got a clear message from Chapel Hill that there were those that thought that moving all the way to stage one may have been premature, take a more cautious approach, and that the expectation was that the WASA board wouldn't watch this extremely closely and not hesitate to act aggressively as we have in the past to return to stage two or higher. And again, our drought is not over, and we would like people to continue to serve. So that completes my presentation. I know Braxton or Ed and myself would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I would just like to thank you and your staff and your board for your extraordinary work during the past 6 months. I think you've done a great job of keeping the community informed, looking at the difference between our usage and the usage in surrounding areas. We're obviously doing a good job, but we wouldn't be doing a good job without the leadership of your staff and board. So thank you very much for
that.
Thank
you.
Great job.
But, of course, at the end of the day, it's not a WASA that conserves water. It's every one of our consumers. So, but
right.
Thank you for your feedback.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ed. So, Mark, is your sense that this move to stage one is a fait accompli and we just have a formality of putting your name on it? Or
I guess I don't really know what I might turn to the attorney for some advice about what would it mean if Chapel Hill and Carrboro had signed off on the move to stage one and Carrboro mayor did not.
Well, I took a look at the ordinance today, and the ordinance provides sort of it's clear in one direction and utterly unclear in the other direction, that it's clear progressing from one stage to a second and third stage. Our ordinance, unlike Chapel Hill's ordinance, however, does, and I'm not sure what Orange County does, but our ordinance provides that the mayor may sign a proclamation that is consistent with the recommendations of OWASA. So it's not an automatic thing. I guess the choices really, it seems to me, are two. I think it's a fairly easy choice to say that you can sort of back down the same way that you came up, that is to say, upon recommendation of OWASA, that you can impose this stage one. I mean, I think that's clear enough, even though it doesn't, there's nothing in the ordinance that specifically or directly provides how you sort of back it down. But I think it's certainly clear enough, implicitly, if not explicitly, that you can back it down upon their recommendation. If you would choose not to do so, then I think it raises a nice enforcement question, since, of course, the ordinance is not the stages of that they establish are sort of enforced in two ways. One is that the stage, as I understand it, establishes different charges, and we don't have anything to do with that. I mean, the charges are whatever the charges will be, or surcharges, however they do that at stage one, because whether you...
In other words, the charge on the water bill, obviously OWASA's there in charge. We don't have any control
right.
over that.
You're not. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not the regulations and restrictions that Cabro enforces or can enforce in our ordinance, which are triggered by your signing the proclamation upon their request, what happens with respect to those? And I would just advise you that if you should choose to say, we want to keep the regulations in effect, the stage three requirements in effect, I think then the prudent thing to do would simply be just to amend the ordinance, which can easily be done with no public hearings and all of that, to make it clear that is the intent. Otherwise, I think it raises at least the possibility of the question that should someone be an enforcement action be taken against someone for violation of a stage three restriction that is not also a violation of a stage one restriction. Leaves up to someone, at least gives them an argument to say, well, that regulation should not be in effect because OWASA's gone back to stage one. Whether that's a legitimate defense or not, I don't know, but my inclination in these matters is always just to clear up an ambiguity when they can easily be done by ordinance amendment. So, you know, if that were your inclination, is to say we want to keep it, the stage three restrictions in force, I would just say we should just, you know, by next week I can have an ordinance amendment drafted that would make that clear. So let me sum up in very, very short order, if I can. Number one, if you want to do what OASA has recommended with their proclamation, that's easy. If you don't, I would just suggest a simple amendment could be drafted to make it clear that you can keep in effect those proclamations or those restrictions.
That's a classic attorney answer in about 500 words to say maybe, but I've got a bunch of people who want to speak, and I want to hear from all of them. I'm going to go to Dan and then to the town manager and then to Commissioner Fushi. Okay. OASA Commissioner Fushi.
Yeah, I'm just going to say flat out that, you know, when I hear the word historic low for April in water, and that last May we were at 100%, and by October we were in trouble, then it strikes to me that this move all the way to stage one is premature and is ill-advised, and I don't support it. And I think there's a broader issue about, you know, what our role is in this decision-making, ours and the Chapel Hill Board and the Orange County Board, and how we all work together as the elected policymakers, where matters of this much import to the well-being of the community, you know, ultimately needs to be our responsibility, and we oughtn't to be rubber-stamping an appointed decision. There needs to be, so this is another discussion, there needs to be, I think we need to talk about how we want to deal with questions like this in the future, and work with our colleagues. And in my saying that, I want to be clear that I really say it with the utmost respect for both the OASA staff and the OASA board and the work they do, but I feel like we have a certain responsibility as elected officials to play a more decisive role in this matter. I guess I also want to suggest that there might be a third option from what Mike has suggested, which, if it's correct that Mayor Foy has not yet signed the proclamation, then it may be that, Mark, you could communicate with him and that there's time to, in fact, revisit whether a stage one proclamation is issued by both towns, or if we want to look at stage two or even continuing at stage three until we see if the lake level continues to rise. Because I do know that there was a lot of concern raised at the Chapel Hill Council meeting last night, you know, similar to what I'm expressing, and that, you know, that Mayor Foy may be amenable to that discussion. So I'll stop there for now.
Mr. Manager,
I just want to point out, while from Mike's perspective it might be easy to draft the ordinance amendment, I don't doubt that. From an enforcement standpoint, I would just point out to the board it creates a very awkward situation, just as this situation unfolded over the past few days, where the OASA board has indicated a move back to stage one. Press releases were sent out indicating that, and then we were put in the position of, I made the call not to enforce anything in stage three because of the confusion until the two towns had an opportunity to discuss it. If Orange County's already signed the proclamation, if Chapel Hill were to sign the proclamation, and we've got two of the three partners at a different level from the town of Carrboro, that creates kind of an interesting public relations situation for the town of Carrboro. And we have been very close partners. I think Ed would tell you, Carrboro and Chapel Hill have worked extremely closely with OASA, putting together press releases, working together and as a team to put out the word from a conservation standpoint and from an enforcement standpoint. And if it looks like we're now about to head in different directions, that's a real departure, I think, from what historically has happened with the communities in OASA.
Mr. Fushi, if you would come up.
Good evening, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak. I just wanted to let you try to give you an idea where my head was when this first came up. And I saw stage two, and I was delighted and confused. The confusion part comes in with the kind of message, the information that I had that y'all didn't have, or Mike probably knows about, is the bill of sales, I mean the agreement with the university, which would, from my thinking, would have put us in a very bad position, because they were asking us, well, in the agreement of sales, university can ask us, or they can obtain water from an outside source, pump it into a WASA, and then use that water. And I was struggling with that, because what kind of message would that send to the community? You go down to the university and you see them watering fields everywhere, all over the place, but yet we're still conserving in town. And then there was the whole swimming pool, athletic fields programs that are going over in Chapel Hill and also going over here, and which would have just come to a complete stop. So my idea was, let's go to stage one, give them a chance to fill those pools, and if we have to, I don't have any problem recommending we go back to stage three, none whatsoever. And we, with what Ed and both Eds came up with, I feel very comfortable going to stage one. What the university was asking us to do was they wanted to be able to water their fields, their obligation to the NC2A, with the baseball, with the soccer, and those fields, water those fields. And to me, that would have sent a real terrible message to the whole community. Everybody is conserving, but yet and still, they can wiggle out, water their fields. And I thought, at least put everybody on the same playing field, and as push come to shove, I'd be the first one to say, let's go back to stage three, with no doubt. And I might be one of the most conservative members on the board. Okay. So I just trying to give you a little idea where my head was.
What were the implications going to stage two involving swimming pools and the fields?
Couldn't do anything.
Right.
If we were in stage two, there would still be no refilling of pools and not watering athletic fields. Or not general sprinkling of water fields.
Right.
If you had under stage two, if you had an operating pool, you could top them off.
Okay, you could top off pools, but you could not refill.
You couldn't refill it.
Okay, you top them off.
She is right. You could not spray irrigate any fields under stage two.
No spray irrigation and no filling of empty pools under stage two.
No.
But the proposal, I mean, what the WASA board has adopted is stage one, which would allow those two things. Okay.
Maybe, Ed, you can answer this for me.
Come up to the mic. Ed. Join Mr. Fushi at the mic, if you would, please.
What I'm wondering is, we really went a long time between October and March that was dry, and I guess when I saw the announcement, I was wondering why now and not maybe at the end of May to try and capture a wet May, which could potentially happen, or even early June. I feel it's premature because I feel that it's still early spring. We're going to have frost tonight. So, it kind of makes me wonder, is this the kind of thing where we might look to amend and revisit it in another 6-8 weeks when we might be able to capture, more recharge?
Yeah. I think some of our thinking is, since it's been wet the last 4 to 6 weeks, finally average or even slightly above average rainfall, so naturally the community's demand for irrigation water is going to be less. And with cooler temperatures, the demand for water for cooling is going to be less. So I think another view is this perhaps is the best time to relax restrictions, monitor them closely. If you have an empty pool, you can fill it. And then if we have to go back to stage two, you can keep operating your pool under stage two. So you can have a complete swim season, perhaps in the spring, summer, and into the fall, if we can get those pools filled. So I think, you know, one point of view on this was our risk model said at this level we are currently in April, in 82 years of history, we would have never reached that that risk factor in the next 12 to 18 months. And again, as Mr. Fushi said, I mean, it was, you know, the board had these same concerns Thursday night, and the message was to be loud and clear. If the demand or supply conditions warrant, we need to quickly go back. But I think some of the thinking had been this might be the best time to relax, watch it closely, and then if we have to, go back. But you have helped pool operators in particular, you know, get their swim seasons underway. And as Mr. Fushi said, you know, we recognize the community, you know, has great value, and it's, we've heard argue it's even a matter of public health to allow folks to enjoy their pools.
Is the swim community aware that they should be using this possibly narrow window to get the pools filled?
Most of them, as Mr. Fushi knows, we've seen quite a bit of people impacted by the drought in our right. meetings since last fall, so chances are they're aware of that. But it's also our intent, and this was an observation made last night at Chapel Hill, was, you know, at stage one, we want Owosso to continue aggressive communications that this drought is not over. We need people to conserve. But we also take that opportunity to make sure people knew what the restrictions were, and then they could, you know, take advantage of them as they saw fit. But again, with the understanding, we're still in drought, use water wisely, and you better use it wisely now, because stage two may be just, you know, 2 or 3 weeks away, maybe even stage three not long thereafter. But I know for the town of Chapel Hill, for instance, they have a huge investment in the new aquatic center. And I think that the town staff had estimated it would cost as much as $40,000 just in transportation cost to move 400,000 gallons of water to fill that pool.
And my other question was, I've always been unclear about, I had thought at one point that the university, that some of their watering for lawns and landscaping was gray water. Or well water, but is it all Owosso water?
No, they have a combination of well water. They also do some harvesting of storm water that is stored in cisterns and used. And of course, as you know, we're now under construction with the reclaimed water system that should be in service this time next year, where they'll use our reclaimed water instead of drinking water in their chiller plants. The university, to their credit, said, at our expense, we're also going to accelerate our plans to put reclaimed water to the ball fields that Mr. Fushi referenced. So, you know, they in the future will be irrigated with reclaimed water rather than potable water. And they're also going to look at a dual, for instance, in their genomics building, it's been designed with a dual plumbing system, and they'll use reclaimed water to flush toilets in that new building.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. It seems to me that one of the issues, not necessarily the central issue for this decision right here, but one important issue that has arisen in my mind, or question has arisen in my mind about the way that our current current three-level system works, is that the current policies make no distinction between public and private swimming pools. And I believe that, not really in the context of our current situation, but going forward, we need to change those rules to not necessarily specifically this, but something like this that would acknowledge that there's a difference between a swimming pool that is in a private individual's yard and serves, you know, one or two families, versus a swimming pool that is held open to the public generally. And we have quite a few pools in our community that are open to the general public, or that are open to or at least open to large groups of people. And I think that we need to draw some type of distinction in our system in the future to ensure that you know, for example, the pool at Hargraves Community Center is something that can be filled under stage two. even though perhaps you might have private swimming pools in people's yards not being filled under those conditions. It's not just a question. I mean, it's the same, 100,000 gallons either way. But the fact is that the number of people that 100,000 gallons is serving, the amount of air conditioning and electricity that 100,000 gallons is cutting down on, is much, much greater with a pool like the pool at Hargraves or at the Chapel Hill Community Center, and probably even some of the pool facilities at the University of North Carolina, as compared with some of the private pools. I don't have a perfect solution in mind to that, but I believe that the WASA board should look strongly at clarifying those rules in order to ensure that that we only cut off the public swimming pools under the most, under stage three when we're in the most dire situation.
That's a great idea, Mark. That's really.
I also think that, I have a concern that, all of us know that Carrboro is a very conservative town, or conservational town anyway. And I think that I'm not sure what the solution ought to be long term to the problems, to some of the issues that Dan Coleman raised earlier in terms of trying to make sure that there's maybe a more collective decision-making process about how we change stages as we head down. But I believe that we do need to develop some system for the future where there's a little bit more coordination in the way that we do that. I think the situation at the university with their need for irrigation of their fields is something that is an exceptional circumstance right now that is not a pressure that we're likely to be under in exactly the same way in a year or two. I do think it's important for the university's athletics program to be able to operate in a reasonably, fairly normal fashion. And I do think that we should, as a community, to the extent that we can, we should avoid the situation where UNC is trying to look to other communities to supply water for the university's needs. Lydia, you had a couple of comments.
Right. I just wanted to echo your suggestion about differentiating swimming pools in some manner because in your point that the point I want to make is that I don't know how many of y'all know kids that go to the swimming pools or on swim teams, but hundreds of youngsters in Chapel Hill and Orange County participate on swim teams and the swim meets, and as well as lessons, et cetera. And the other thing is that beyond just those, I mean, that the swimming pools in town serve as one of the few places where teenagers can get jobs, where young teenagers or teenagers can get jobs and work kind of all summer. I know a lot of them have been kind of wondering if they're going to have a job this summer. And also, they serve as a kind of a an older child care kind of situation. It's a lot of parents, that's their child care plan for their teenagers in a pretty good one when they take turns going to different pools in the afternoon and morning. So it serves my point is it serves a lot more than just, filling up a swimming pool.
Well, I don't know that we necessarily need a formal motion. This is under the way that the ordinance is crafted. It's essentially my decision, if I understand. I mean, Mr. Attorney, you correct me if I'm wrong about how we'll change. I think I will just say that I have received this board's input, and I'm going to give it some consideration and make a decision about what I'm going to do tomorrow, probably tomorrow morning sometime. And we will we'll proceed from there. But I really appreciate this board taking the time to take up this topic, and also I really appreciate the WASA staff and board member Fushi coming out tonight to share their perspective and input on the issue.
Mark, can you also in your meditations consider what procedurally we might do in the future to kind of change the dynamic of this sort of decision. You know, because I think, you know, that's an area where for you to talk to Mayor Foy could perhaps be fruitful in terms of seeing where Chapel Hill's at and if there's some kind of process that the governing bodies, and I guess that would include Chairman Jacobs as well, in terms of being more, I guess, proactively engaged in this kind of decision.
Right. Well, I think we're it's a little bit awkward how where we stand right now, but on the other hand, we're on a, this is the first step on a path toward a more sort of collective decision making about this sort of thing in the future. And our conversation tonight is partly inspired by conversations that Mayor Foy and I had late last week. So, but I will talk to him tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
As a part of this.
I appreciate you bringing it to the board, too.
All right. Thank you all. We will turn to the consent agenda, Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item 1 is approval of minutes of all previous meetings of April 1st and April 8th. Item 2 is a request to set a public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment to provide for conditional use zoning, and that public hearing date would be May 27th. Item 3 is a request to set a public hearing to consider a minor map amendment for the property located at 102 Center Street from R75 to B2 conditional, again for May 27th. Item 4, appointments to the Recreation and Parks Commission. I would call your attention to a handout at your place from the clerk, which adds some additional appointees, I believe, to the list you'd gotten in your original packet.
One additional.
Okay. It's been moved for the four items. All those and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously. The second was from Lydia Lavelle, in case you didn't get that on the tape. Item D1, Mr. Manager.
This is a report on the UNC Department of City and Regional Planning Workshop parking study. Students at the UNC's Department of City and Regional Planning have studied the supply and demand of parking in downtown Carrboro and have prepared a report of their study for presentation to the board. Staff recommends the board receive the report and provide comments, and I think Adina Messinger, our transportation planner, is going to introduce the students. Adina?
Good evening. I'm going to pull up their presentation real quickly. Okay. Just a few words of background for this agenda item. This past fall, the town was fortunate to have been approached by Professor Daniel Rodriguez from the UNC Department of City and Regional Planning for some workshop ideas for his spring master's students workshop. And the town presented several ideas, and the students ended up picking, looking at parking in downtown Carrboro as their choice of topic. And so they've been working since January with some guidance from town staff to examine parking supply and demand in the downtown. And they are here this evening to present to you their findings. A final report will be completed by the end of the month. Staff has provided a resolution for this agenda item in your packet. I would like to just briefly add that I know that both James Harris and myself have very much enjoyed working with what we think is an exceptional group of students. So I'm pleased to introduce Denman Glover, Chava Cronenberg, Michael Schwartz, and Bridget Veen, who will actually be giving the presentation.
Hey, thank you, Adina, and thank you, Board, for having us here. My name is Michael Schwartz, and Adina did a pretty good job introducing the study, so I won't say too much more about that. I just want to give a quick overview of what the scope of the project is. This is just an initial exploratory study, so we're looking at supply and demand as it exists currently, and then we took land use and some future development and tried to project into the future what some of the future supply and demand might look like. We also conducted a business survey just to get a look at what some of the perceptions are of parking from some of the business owners in Carrboro. And then we're going to make some initial recommendations and possible solutions. And again, these are just initial ideas to be put in the back of your heads as you move forward, but we do have in the final report more ideas about what future studies and things can be done to build off of our findings as well. So the very first thing that we did was we knew we needed to get a good count of how many spaces there were in the downtown district. We knew there had been some previous studies, there were some numbers out there, but we had a sense that they really were not that accurate. And so what we did was we sat down with Adina and James and picked the pertinent lots and streets, on-street parking that we thought would be most pertinent to the area. And then we went out and we hand-counted all the spaces in the parking lots out there. And we divided them into unrestricted spaces, so spaces that are available for anyone to come and use day or night, as well as restricted spaces such as handicap parking, reserved customer parking, or reserved employee parking. So these are the lots that we surveyed. And just to give you a sense of where we are, this is Weaver Street right down here, right in front of Carmel Mall. So when you see the maps later on, just look for that angled street, and that'll help orient you. And the green lots are the private lots. The brown ones are public. And the pink ones are the Carmel lots, as well as the Carmel overflow lot down to the bottom. And those are pink because we weren't actually allowed to hand count them at the request of the owners there, but we do have the number of spaces in their development proposal, so we feel pretty confident that those numbers are close. So once we got the counts, we actually divided the central business district into three areas, mostly because we had an assumption that turned out to be right, that most of the parking demand and potential issues would be right in the center of the district there in Zone B. So we divided it up that way, and once we did that, we put all the parking lots in one in their proper zone and counted it up. And between all these three zones, there's 2,650 spaces currently, and that's from all the lots that we showed you on the previous slide. And then within Zone B, we further subdivided because we felt that there might be a difference in the types of demand depending on time of day and different patterns of parking. So we divided them into subzones. And you can see there's three of them. And on the far left, that actually was counted in both subzones 1 and 2. So subzone 3 on the right over here, this has the Carborough Arts Center, including the Cat's Cradle, that parking lot. Subzone 2 has the Carmel lot with Harris Teeter and Weaver Street Market. Subzone 1 has the strip of shops along Main Street, like Orange County Social Club, Spotted Dog, et cetera. And after we did all the counts for the supply count, we do feel that we have a much more accurate number than the town had before, and these are the most accurate counts to date. And we'd like to suggest that moving forward, these numbers, we've given them over to the town, are used in any future studies of the parking in Carborough. And so once we had the supply, we knew we needed to see, was this adequate? And so we did a demand analysis.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about our demand analysis. So the idea is we had supply. So what we need to learn about the scope of when and why parking was being demanded. And we had the sense that obviously, in different zones, there's going to be different amounts of demand at any given time. So prior to even counting, we talked with James and Adina, and we predetermined peaks for different zones. And so in Zone A, we checked at 2 o'clock when we assumed there'd be customers and employees, so the most amount of customers in the lot about 2 o'clock. In other areas, there was not so defined a peak hour, so we check them at more frequent intervals. For instance, around glass half full, we check them at 9 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, and 6 at night. And so how did we look at demand? We wanted to get a sense of occupancy. So for the private lots, we were able to hand count at their peak hour how many cars were in a lot. For public lots, we were able to look at turnover. So not just how many cars are in a space, but how frequently are they moving? How many cars are we going to get in a space over the course of a day? And for the Carmel areas, we used 2 counts in order to determine how many cars were in those lots. The threshold for a time that you might want to consider getting more parking is, in our field, considered 85%. So when we look further, just remember that 85% is considered that time that maybe we need to think about either changing demand or changing supply. And when did we use these counts? We did them in February for 1 week. We did them on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. So these are not averages. This is every time we see a day, that's going to be the one day that we counted it.
And what were the times?
Well, it depended on the zone. So every zone was subdivided by when the peak hour was. And you'll see that what we would later do is, because different areas had different peaks, we would take a chunk of time and sort of look at what we found across that time period. And so I'll go a little bit further into that in a minute or so. So this is, for instance, the Tuesday from 6 to 9 p.m. time. So obviously we did not check between West Weber and West Main during those times because that was not considered the peak. And we'll move into that later. But you can see during this time we get red areas at Cat's Cradle and at the Bank of America lot. But very close by we have lots of green and lots of yellow saying that there is plenty of capacity available. And moreover is that our public lots, especially that one on West Weber, is at 40% capacity. So there is, so though there may be places that are at high occupancy levels, there's plenty of spaces available within a 3-minute walk. And that's at this time. And so before I switch to the next slide, we wanted to paint a picture, which is if the absolute worst case scenario to happen, if there were a brunch and there were an event at Cat's Cradle in the Art Center and all the customers for all the stores were to come in, what would that look like for Carrboro? So this is a completely hypothetical situation, and it's never going to happen. So what? So obviously we know, as any of us have gone to Carrboro know, there are going to be areas that are going to be at very high occupancies at some times. But just as clearly, there are many spaces that are not at full occupancy, and specifically our public lots have quite a bit of space. But also many of our private lots are available. And so while we're not assuming that there is a shared parking, we understand that there is in general a sort of interaction between many of our businesses here and who are willing to share at least informally some of their parking spaces. So next we wanted to get a sense of, you know, overall within a zone, what occupancy percentages are we at? And so this slide is an aggregation of the supply that we had counted and the demand for it. So it's not because we didn't count all the lots at that time, it's only the amount of supply, the lots that we examined and the demand for those lots. So here in Zone A, we see it's at the same Tuesday early evening time, which we ascertained to be our worst case scenario based on highest levels of occupancy in the majority of the lots. We had in Zone A 30 to 40%. Occupancy, in Zone B is 70 to 80%, and Zone C is 40 to 50%. So just as we all know, Zone B was experiencing the highest levels of occupancy. And within the subzones, subzones 2 and subzones 3 are at, they're reaching that threshold where we need to start looking at options. And at subzone 1, we have 55 to 65%. So again, even within areas that are experiencing high occupancy, there are still some spaces available in not such a far distance. So the next thought that we're going to look at is the turnover, which we only did, again, for the public spaces. And why turnover is important is because if we need to make parking more available, the easiest way is to keep cars moving. In general, there is a two-hour time limit, and it is unenforced within Carrboro. So in our public lots, the two-hour limit's not enforced. So we checked at three-hour intervals, and of these bars, you notice so that we have a 0 to 70% is the level of occupancy within the lot, but the bar we can see is about 20%. The red, which is the exceeding of 3 hours, is about 20% across the board in every zone. So Zone B does have a higher rate of occupancy.
Excuse me, why did you break it at 3 hours rather than at two?
Because we had a limited number of people who were able to count cars, and so we had to decide how frequently we were able to check, and we decided at 3 hours. We did it at 9, noon, 3, and so on. And so it was sort of a constraint based on the number of people we had working on this project. But, I mean, in general, even at 3 hours, we know that a car has exceeded that time. And some cars actually went beyond 6 hours, but not always. And in general, we can see 20% of these cars have exceeded our three-hour limit in our zones. And so I'm going to break that down by time. The reason we're going to look at the next two slides is because there's, in general, been a pinpointing of certain characters who might be the culprits of the exceeding of time, and it's almost always the UNC students who are labeled as those who might drive in, park their car, walk to school, come back 5 hours later, and leave. But as we can see from the next two slides, first of all, there's a wide dispersion of time when those 2 hours are being violated. And, you know, you're going to get students less frequently at 9 o'clock, and yet there's still 20% of our vehicles have been over for 3 hours. And more importantly is we don't see any difference between our weekday and our weekend. There's no difference. So though UNC students absolutely may be culprits, there may be others who are just doing it just as well. For instance, if a basketball game at a bar is going to be about 2.5 hours, these people are going to be violating the time limit. Or employees who are parking, you know, approximately to their business and maybe don't have parking provided. So I think when we were not able to get a sense of who these people are, but if there is, you know, further look at this, it shouldn't just be a sort of blanketed statement over who it might be.
When you count, say, a 12 and a 3,
mm-hmm.
And the orange part of the bar, are those different vehicles, or can those be the same vehicle that stayed there 6 hours rather than just three?
We're talking about the previous map?
That
is literally just a snapshot of how many cars are in that lot. And so some of those may have been there longer, but we were only able to look at public lots for turnover because private lots, we didn't have that sort of access. We were, you know, we're able to go in and count.
You identified who was there at 12, and then you checked to see if they were still there at 3.
That's correct. So
then when you checked at 6,
mm-hmm.
did you identify who was there who had still been there at 12?
Yeah, let me go a little more clearly into that. We chalked tires, so the first person who would come at 9 in the morning would say, I see cars in these spaces, and you would chalk every single car, and the next person who came at noon would then say, I see these cars in these spaces, and then make a chalk mark. So if there's two chalk marks, you know they'd stayed for, you know, they've been there 9 a.m. and they've been there at noon. And if there's only one, then they'd only been there at noon. And so on. And in fact, we found a number of cars that stayed for the entire tenure of the week. So, I mean, those got counted a few times. And they might still be there to this day. I have not checked. And so we're going to... So... Turnover is only going to be revisited again in our conclusions, but it's a really critical component to the study, which is you got to keep people moving if we want to keep spaces available. And so now Denman is going to take us into the thought of what happens in the future.
Okay, so land use. We did this for two reasons. First of all, we wanted to be able to express parking supply and demand in terms of business building square footage, which is what the town ordinance says when a developer comes in and says, we want to build this building. The town asks, well, how many square feet is it going to be? This is how much parking you need, parking spaces per square feet. So we did a land use analysis both to express our findings in those spaces per square feet terms and also to provide a number to look at the proposed and approved developments coming in and see how they might impact the parking situation in town. Again, we used Tuesday early evening as the base case, worst case scenario to generate these numbers. Our findings were basically, one other thing is that the new approved and proposed developments are just going into Zone B, specifically subzones 1 and 3. These include 300 East Main, Valberta. If you want more details, they're in the report, but there are 5 developments included in this. And this, just to orient people again, this is Weaver Street, Spud Dog, Cat's Cradle. The existing occupancy didn't change for zones A and B, but within zone B, we find that with the approved amount of developments going in, the occupancy we will expect to jump from 55 to 65% to 65 to 75%, and then if the proposed developments go in as proposed, it'll jump up to 75 to 85%. So again, kind of approaching that threshold at which you might want to consider solutions for more parking or changing demand. Specifically, subzone 3 created the greatest demand, and that jumps from 80% to 90% under existing to 85% to 95% under approved, up to 100% to 100% under proposed. And so,
does that include the proposed parking deck?
Yes, it does. It includes 565 spaces for the parking deck, plus 650 total for the development, with the existing just surface parking that they have.
Okay, and so even with that, it's over 100% as well?
Yes. Oops, excuse me. It does not include what might happen to the Arts Center and parking associated with Arts Air. So,
what was the difference again between approved and proposed?
The approved developments are ones that have already gone through the town approval process and will be built. The proposed are, for example, 300 East Main Phase B that have paperwork in with the town but haven't gone through the approval process yet.
Did you include the parking that would come with the proposed also?
For these numbers, yes.
The approved and the proposed?
Yes. They're separated out, so you have existing, approved, and proposed. Existing, approved, and proposed. And they just get a little bit worse with each. Yeah. And all of the numbers and details are in the report if you want to go and look at them yourself. With that, though, I'll turn it over to Bridget, who is looking at the business surveys.
In addition to our demand, supply, and land use analyses, we also worked with the town of Carrboro to administer a business survey to businesses in the downtown area. Our goal with this was twofold. One, to get an idea of business locations and the parking they may generate for employees, for owners, and for customers. And two, to see what the impressions in the business community were about the availability of parking in general. So we administered this by both email and by in paper form to the Carrboro Business Administration. Let's see. We had 29 responses in total. Of those responses, about 25 of 29, when asked, said parking is insufficient. I believe about the same number reported parking shortages during a particular area of time. That's a little bit more detailed. That would be in the report. In addition, 25 of 29 favored some form of structured parking. Now, in the comments, many people took the opportunity to clarify what they meant by that. Some people said, we want a parking garage underground. Some people said, we want a parking deck, but only if it's this tall. Some people said, we want a parking deck in this particular location. So it was it varied considerably among these respondents. Another thing that the survey told us was that the business community in general did not believe parking enforcement or parking metering would greatly assist the amount of parking available in downtown Carrboro. So not necessarily in favor of it, but also didn't believe that it would be an effective solution. And really what this survey tells us is that the opinion of people and their perception is different from what we have measured in the town. And so any potential solution is going to be impacted by the fact that people have an expectation of being able to park close to where they shop, of being able to find spaces relatively quickly. So that may or may not reflect the actual physical situation, but it will affect our recommendations and solutions. And then just to go over our key findings for you, we do find that overcapacity, again, where the amount of parking demand is 85% of the supplied parking, is where the traditional threshold is to be looking for additional parking, we find that to not be a very widespread issue. We do find some times when this capacity was either at 85% or over 85%, but it's very site and time specific, so it's very critical to time of day and then location as well. We do find very high turnover in all of the public lots, but we do find violation of the traditional two-hour limit. We also saw that the majority of visitors to downtown park in lots directly adjacent to the businesses they're patronizing. For example, at times when Cat's Cradle would be full and we would see that lot being full, several lots around it would not have very high occupancies at all. We also have a perception of insufficient parking from the business owners who responded. And then we also do have the potential overcapacity issue in subzone 3, which does need to be addressed. So now Michael will go ahead and go over our recommendations.
Okay, so again, these are just preliminary ideas for solutions. We're not saying you have to do any of these, or these are just ideas to keep in the back of your head as you move forward. And I just want to draw your attention quickly to the asterisks. Those are ones that have been recommended in either previous parking studies or in town policy documents. So these, you may want to look at those closely, because more people than just us have thought of them. And these are just ideas that have worked in other towns like Carrboro, and you will obviously need to find a combination that works best. So the first one, for the sake of time, I'm just going to talk about the ones in yellow. The first one is education and signage. So back to the point that people are parking sort of right adjacent to where the businesses they're patronizing, this really could be an education issue that people, we don't know why they're not parking farther away. It could be that they don't want to. It could be that they don't know about additional parking. It could be they feel unsafe walking farther. Further analysis needs to be done to find that out, but an education to show that there are parking spaces available, signage saying public parking one block this way, that will both let them know where the parking is and maybe change some of the ideas about how close you should be to parking and that you could need to walk a little bit farther if you're frustrated right in front of your business. The next thing is stricter enforcement. With that two-hour rule, if we were to just hypothetically look through maybe 100 spaces that are in 100 public spaces that are in Zone B, if 20% of those are violating that two-hour rule, well, if that were to happen a few times a day, say at 9, noon, or at noon, 3, and 6, then you're basically creating 60 spaces by enforcing that rule, and that's totally free to the town, free to the businesses. In fact, if anything, you make money by enforcing the tickets. The next one is pedestrian amenities. We have heard from some business owners that people are afraid for their employees to walk home after hours, and this is sort of something that we've thought a lot about in this recommendation page is, what is the actual problem? That there are perceptions of certain things being problems. Some things are manifestations. Parking could be the manifestation of a different problem. Well, if people are afraid to walk, that is a safety problem, and things like more lighting, better sidewalks, maybe even an off-street or a plainclothes police officer, those are things that can address that issue, not in addition to parking or instead of parking, just things to think about. And those also do help improve some of the other goals of the town, which is to make the community more walkable, more eyes on the street, possibly limiting. If you change some of the modes, you can see bicycle is another way of getting there. So if you're improving those amenities, you may address other problems like congestion in the community. And the final thing is the parking deck. We know that there are going to likely be some parking decks in future developments, and the town may have an opportunity to get some spaces as well. And what we would say is that that can certainly address very site-specific things. That from our findings, people who that parking deck would benefit would be very site-specific, and if you were able to maybe do it in combination with other things like pedestrian amenities, then you'd be able to get someone to walk from subzone 3 to subzone 1. But the parking deck by itself would not necessarily solve A parking deck in subzone 3 would not necessarily solve an issue in subzone 1. And overall, we're finding that each one of these is much less powerful than when used together as a comprehensive suite of solutions. And as you move forward, you're going to want to think about things that are cost-effective and what is the best combination to make it work correctly. So that's it. Thank you.
Nice job.
Alderman Coleman.
Thank you all. Now, we had our retreat at the beginning of February where we talked about parking, and kind of what we said at that time was, well, we have this study coming and we're going to get some good data to make some decisions on, and I really feel like you all have given us that. So thank you very much for this work. My question is actually for James Harris. If you could come up and answer my question. Thank you. I'm wondering if what your sense is of the thoroughness of the business responses to the survey. Did we get, I mean, are you aware of who responded and who didn't, and was there follow-up, and did we get the businesses whose opinions we need to really to really gauge the sense of the downtown business community?
I think we might need to collect some more data from the business community. I don't think that's truly representative of all the feelings.
Okay.
So we need to do a little bit more work on that.
Okay. So in terms of, as part of the follow-up that staff may do to this,
yes,
would include addressing that.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of you. It's a really great job, and don't forget to put it on your resumes. It's really, really good. My concern, and this is something that we as a town will have to deal with, it's certainly no reflection on your work, is that your census was done in the spring, and where Tuesday night's your peak, and we all know, and I'm sure you know, that there's Thursday night, and there's Sunday, and then there's Saturday, kind of beginning right now as the weather begins to warm, and that has a complete change in what's going on. But I think you gave us some good base data to work with, and then we'll go add to that. But thank you.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And just to not confuse the issue, we showed Tuesday evening maps, but we do have maps for also Saturday and Sunday evening as well. And one of the nights, the Saturday night, was actually in February, 75-degree, beautiful night with the Vagina Monologues was at the Art Center, and there was a big show at the Cat's Cradle, and we really got that lot was packed. Mm-hmm. I mean, 100% packed. And we know it's still not – we didn't capture the farmer's market. We have other things to do. And in the report, we do recommend some follow-up studies, and definitely things will need to be done at different times of year and different time of day as well.
But this is a great foundation.
Yeah, really. I have to say, just not on the public policy issues, but on the procedural, the method that you use for doing this analysis, that I think this is really great. It shows that I think you thought about this, how to approach it in a very systematic way, and carried out your sort of data collection in a way that makes a lot of sense to me. Obviously, there'll end up being a whole bunch of other factors and things that as a community that we'll need to think about in making our decisions about how to proceed. But just commenting for a moment just on the class project, I think it's a really great piece of work. So I hope it turns out well for you in terms of high pass or something like that. Although, as my grad student friends tell me, P equals PhD. So, anyway, I do think well, I guess we're being asked to do is refer this, receive this, and refer it to the staff. So, it would be appropriate to have a motion for that effect.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that we receive and refer this to staff. I think we've given some direction in the past that we would like, and I'm assuming this is still where the board is at, that we want to approach, that this is one piece of the puzzle, but that we want to, as a town, approach the question of, in terms of the overall accessibility of our downtown to people who need to get there, and that, you know, parking is one component of that, but also pedestrianism and bicycling and mass transportation are also going to be key parts of that we're going to want to look at in an overall approach to the question of how to improve the accessibility of our downtown. So I'm assuming that's sort of implicit in that motion as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that we receive and refer this. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, they're passed unanimously. Thanks a lot,
Delphine.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We're on to item D2, a request for approval of municipal agreement between North County Department of Transportation and the town for conceptual planning for Bowling Creek Greenway.
This was an item that was first brought to the board on February 19th. Where we presented a municipal agreement that would enable the town to use federal funds for the conceptual planning of Bowling Creek Greenway Trail and also Morgan Creek, which was approved at that meeting. It was the consensus of the board to refer the Bowling Creek Municipal Agreement to the Greenways Commission for recommendation. The resolution authorizing the mayor and clerk to sign and execute the municipal agreement is recommended for Board of Aldermen approval. We don't have a presentation on hand, but I've got two board members at the table who are members of the Greenways Commission, and Adina Messinger is here, as is Anita Jones McNair, who also was involved with the Greenway Commission.
We'll move that way.
I think Randy and I both appreciate the work of staff and of the commission. We'd like to do some clarifying of the commission's recommendation. There's a lot of debate within town and within this board of the surfaces to be used and the width and all of that when it comes to the greenway, particularly as it pertains to the creek and how close it is to the creek. Randy had a great idea, and that's what's incorporated in the recommendation from that commission, is that we ask the firm that we will be contracting with to look at different places to put the path. And so what you have before you tonight is not a presumption that the path would run right next to Bowling Creek. I'll let Randy explain more what she meant.
Well, and thank you, Jackie. We had a spirited discussion in the Greenway Commission meeting, and Jackie and I have been working on this well over a year, working with the Greenway Summit work group and working with folks from Friends of Bowling Creek and the Morgan Creek Valley Alliance. And in order to be able to fuse the interest in going after this grant with the development of Greenway, one of the things that we needed to start to think about was how to meet several interests and needs of the community as expressed by interest in trails and greenways. So one of the things that not only came out of all of the discussions over a good couple of years building into the Greenway Commission, but also came out of the Carolina North discussions, was to have some transit corridor that would work not only for the schools that are in the Boland Forest, the Carolina North area, which is Chapel Hill High School, Smith Middle School, Sewell Elementary School, and the fields and tennis courts near Homestead, but not only to connect those to Carolina North, but also to connect it to the neighborhoods north of Homestead. So the idea that I brought up before the Greenway Commission was to think of using an asphalted or concrete, and I would hope that we would consider asphalt rather than the concrete, to run behind the schools to go from the Homestead and the fields behind the high school, behind all the schools that I mentioned, down along Sewell. There's lots of trails that way, and that way students would be able to use it as a bike corridor, and folks would be able to connect to Carolina North at a later point. So I would hope that we would embrace whatever kinds of insights the consultants have, but realize that we don't have to be limited to and restrict ourselves or constrain ourselves to thinking of trailway and asphalt along the creek, because I know that I've been hearing from lots of folks that was not the original interest and intent of having Greenway in the Boland Forest area. So hopefully this would support that.
Are you proposing a modification to the resolution?
No. All I'm saying is that
context to
okay. Right. The reason that we sought to kind of amplify was that the resolution was to be able to capture that.
Well, I'll be interested to kind of see where that process, how that process plays out, or what kind of alignment we come up with coming out of that. But I think, increasing the bicycle and pedestrian connectivity through that general area that you just described is the basic point of the project. And I'm sure there's a bunch of different ways to get it done. So I'll take that as a motion, if I may, Randy, for the resolution.
Second.
A second from Dan Coleman. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. We are on the proposed home program allocation. Mr. Manager, I think this is a fairly straightforward set of recommendations. I believe one alderman has a question about it, but if we might.
No questions. I'll move the item.
Okay, there are no questions. It's been moved and seconded for the proposed allocation per the committee's recommendation. All those, I would like to ask the board to recuse me from voting on this matter, actually, since I work indirectly for several of these organizations.
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that I be recused. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
All right. So
we have a motion.
Do we have the motion?
A motion. And it's been seconded.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion passes unanimously. With the recused member.
Good job, John. Well, James will try to get over his disappointment of not being able to make the presentation.
I think Dancing with the Stars may not be over yet, so you can catch that. Annual report on the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System.
The town of Carrboro was issued an NPDES stormwater permit in July of 2005. The permit includes annual performance requirements for each of its 5 years. The purpose of this agenda item is to update the board on staff activities for year 3 of the permit, which requires best management practices, implementation, operation, maintenance, and inspection, establishment of an illicit discharge detection and elimination program, provisions for protecting nutrient-sensitive water. Some of these requirements have already been addressed in prior years, and a resolution accepting the staff memorandum is recommended for adoption. And, Randy, I think you have a presentation, and this listing was hopefully almost as long as your presentation.
So as Steve mentioned, I'm just going to try to give you a little bit of background for those of you who may be a little bit new to this program, and mainly update you on activities we're currently involved on in at the staff level and will be involved in for the next couple of months. This stormwater permit that we have through the state operates on an annual, we have a five-year permit that has an annual reporting requirement at the end of June, so we're gearing up for submitting our report this June. NPDES is the acronym. It stands for the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, federal legislation that came in 1972. Originally, a lot of the emphasis in NPDES was on wastewater, both municipal as well as industrial. And in more recent phases of this program, there's been more of an emphasis on stormwater. It is recognized on all sorts of levels that stormwater is a leading cause of impairment to surface waters, including here in Carrboro. The stormwater permitting under NPDES has occurred in two phases. Initially, it was phase one was focusing on large cities greater than 100,000. Actually, I missed a zero there. And phase two is for municipalities less than 100,000 people, and we fall in that category. It's federal legislation, but it's being carried out by the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. The Division of Water Quality is the agency there that oversees this program. Phase two rules were promulgated in 2002. At a minimum, just in general, this program requires us to develop, implement, and enforce a stormwater management program designed to reduce the discharge of pollutants from the municipal storm sewer system to the maximum extent practicable, and protect water quality. Our permit includes six components I'm showing here. And I'm not going to talk about all of these tonight, but I just wanted to make you aware that they all are involved in what we do. This year, the focus is on the two yellow starred ones, this year being the year 3 of the permit. And this includes establishment of a program for what is known as illicit discharge detection elimination. I'll go into that in a little more detail. And there's also some provisions for looking at what is known as a post-construction stormwater management, and I'll talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about the illicit discharge piece. This is just the cover page of our permit, and what I wanted to show here on the right is that there are about 30 different elements of our permit that we keep track of. Over to the right of this table, you'll see that there's a number of columns up here. This is for each year of the permit, and each of these asterisks is different things we have to do in different years. These yellow ones are the ones we're focusing on in year three and relate to the illicit discharge and post-construction stormwater aspect. We have this spreadsheet, and I'm looking at it all the time to see how we're doing with different things. Illicit discharge program, the purpose is to develop and implement this program, and it includes provisions for assessment and evaluation of how well we're doing. And as part of this, we also need to make sure we have established the adequate legal authorities to prohibit illicit discharge and enforce this program. So we're simultaneously working on that piece of it. These are things we must do per our permit. We must locate all the major pipes and outfalls and understand the topography and general flow of the system. We've pretty much done that. We've worked on that, actually got started on that very early. We're just doing some minor updates to that at this point. We must prohibit illicit discharge into our storm sewer system. We must implement a plan to detect and address illicit discharges. And we must inform employees, businesses, and the general public of hazards associated with illicit discharges. So at this point in time, we're working on developing a plan for this program. We're looking at our stormwater system and updating our inventory to that. And we have prepared a storm system map, and so we're just updating that. We need to develop the regulatory mechanisms, the legal authority, and we're working on that. And we're developing a plan for the detection, correction, and prevention of illicit discharge. I should say with all of this, these are things we have had to do to some extent historically. And what we're doing now is really formalizing our program and formalizing our legal authority and making it clearer and tighter and more explicit about how we go about doing this. So while this is a new requirement of this permit, the things that we have to do for this are things we've had to do in the past. And so we're just trying to sort of be even more formal and clearer and tighter ship, if you will, about how we do it. Other things we have to do as part of this program include evaluating the stream monitoring that we've got going on. We need to explore cooperative arrangements. This can be with Chapel Hill. This can be with Owassa, or where the county health department could get involved at times. And we need to do these other things as well, which I'm not going to go into the details of. They're all important parts of the program. Basically, the problem of illicit discharge, in a nutshell, is whenever there's anything that is not associated with runoff from rainfall that's pollution-oriented, that's going through the storm system. So we call this non-stormwater discharge. This is not rainfall-induced. But this is some other source of pollution that's going through the system.
Randy, could you give an example of the kind of thing that might arise? Just so
a good example, and I'll get into this in a little bit more in a moment, is when there's some entry into the storm system of sewage.
Mm-hmm.
That's one example, and I'll point out a few more here in a minute. And so we talk about illicit discharges. This is when we notice that there's some discharge coming out of our storm system that is something we don't want to be seeing coming through the storm system. And you also hear the term used, illicit connections. And this is when there's actually some legacy of historical development and infrastructure that there's been a pipe that has improperly been connected to the system at a point in time when it wasn't regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And so where there are these illicit connections, they're not, they weren't put in purposely as illicit connections, but at the time they were put in before this whole concern came about, they were just a legacy we've inherited. We need to find out if we've got any of those, and if we do, then try to disconnect those situations. Illicit discharges are all non-urban runoff. It's another way of saying non-stormwater runoff discharges to our drainage system. It's important that, you know, we got to be concerned about violation of state water quality or sediment quality or groundwater quality standards. They could be sanitary sewer connections. There could also be industrial or commercial process water, interior floor drains, car washes, gray water. Those are other examples of the kinds of things we need to be concerned about with this program. In the things we're looking at now, we're also being very clear about what we wouldn't consider as an illicit discharge, and these are some of the, perhaps the prime examples of these kind of things. So just normal landscape irrigation and lawn watering. If groundwater, uncontaminated groundwater springs are entering the system, that's not considered problematic. If the potable water system has some leakage that's getting into the system, foundation drains, water from crawl space pumps, et cetera. So these are the kinds of things that we would exempt from any kind of implementation of the program. As I mentioned a moment ago, I mean, this is probably the thing we're going to have highest on our radar as we look forward to considering this program. It's where there might be some interaction between the wastewater system and the stormwater system. So the other piece of the program that we're going to be looking at falls under what's known as the post-construction runoff control requirements. And it turns out that we were forward-looking with this piece. While it's a year three requirement, are the things we need to do for BMP operation and maintenance and inspections we've already implemented in our land use ordinance, so we're hopefully good to go. But the other thing I did want to bring to your attention is that there is a requirement in our permit that we look at nutrients because of requirements in Jordan Lake, and I wanted to be real clear that this was for rules that were instated in 1983, and this is not the new round of draft rules that have come up. But our permit does specifically require, as a function of our discharging into Jordan Lake nutrient-sensitive waters, that we, as we review and consider BMPs for stormwater runoff, that we prioritize those BMPs that are most effective for nutrient loading. And we also need to think about where there's fertilizer applied within our jurisdiction, if we want to, how we want to have some oversight to make sure that fertilizer is being applied in a responsible fashion. So this is basically a heads up that we're looking at this, and we do have an intention of bringing this back onto your agenda. I believe it's the May 20th, this meeting in May 20th. And okay. If you have any feedback to guide us as we're working on this in the interim, or other thoughts to pass on, we'd certainly love to get that feedback.
All right.
Thank you, Andy. That was very good, and I like your splashy ending there. I'd like to move resolution. We have attachment A, which is receiving the staff report on the stormwater permit.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded for the resolution. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
All right. Item D5, a discussion of legislative issues for the 2008 General Assembly short session. I have a couple of comments on that, but Mr. Manager, did you have a presentation?
We have no presentation. You have the attachments, and I also think Alderman Coleman had asked that you all be
right.
given a copy of the program from last year, which should be at your places.
Right. Okay. So I just would like to launch into this topic by pointing out that, let's see, it's an even-numbered year, so it's a short session for the General Assembly and also an election year for them. So they do tend to be, focus on sort of less controversial topics in even-numbered years. And I'm glad that Dan asked for a copy of the resolution we passed last time in terms of what our agenda is. I think a lot of those things can probably be continued on to the agenda for this year. But are there any specific items that board members wanted to bring up, Dan?
Yeah, a couple things. One is The campaign finance item actually never got onto the printed agenda last year, and Lydia and I met with the delegation about, was it about a month ago, I guess, to talk about that, and that's expected to move forward. But, you know, we may want to touch base on that again at the breakfast this time, just to make sure all the ducks are in their proper row. Something I would like to add, and I don't know if this has been on our agenda in the past or not, but is the repeal of General Statute 95-98, which is the statute that forbids collective bargaining for public employees, and I would like to see that repeal. There is a growing movement across the state for the repeal of that, and that's something I'd like to talk about with our delegation. Also, I had some discussion, actually both with Randy and with Lydia earlier, about whether we should want to have a wholesale endorsement of the Triangle J and the League's agenda, which is what's implied here. Right. And my feeling is that both those organizations do important work on behalf of the communities they represent, and that I feel like that we should have an indication of general support, and when there are items that we specifically disagree with, that we should note those and make sure that our legislators are aware of that disagreement.
Did you want to point out anything specific along those lines in either of these at this point?
Well, they did. You know, it was in last year. I didn't notice it this time.
They had some really heavy-handed stuff in
they
the...
They had an anti-union item, you know, which I didn't see in there this time, but, you know, that's certainly something that I believe we did specifically disagree with that last year when it came up, that we passed resolution.
And I think the League has taken some strong positions on contributory negligence as opposed to comparative negligence and that type of thing, which I think we won't go into, but I doubt if very many of us support.
Well, I think Lydia has something on that.
Yeah. Lydia?
Yeah, I mean, Dan's talking a little bit about what we discussed, but While looking generally at the principles and advocacy agenda that was in our packet, which is also on the website, I think it's kind of a broad statement to say support for the legislative agenda, because I think there are some positions that the League takes that we're not in support of, and it might be confusing to say we support the agenda and then, you know, but somewhere else. I mean, I remember this in particular because I was at the training for newly elected officials, and they made a presentation at lunchtime, and they were talking, and some of the things they said, I thought, well, I'm not so sure that I agree with that. Although, in general, overall, I agree with most of what they are support and arguing for, and I spoke also with Steve about it. So I just feel like it almost dilutes the specificity of our other recommendations to have these kind of broad, you know, generalizations of support. The other comment I have, Mark, is I know we talk about statewide funds for mass transportation. We might want to even specifically say something about, was it the 21st Century Committee that came before the MPO last week and kind of said that they were putting forward some bills. We might even want to refer specifically to what they referred to at the meeting.
Although this board might want to hear more specifically about what that is, which I wouldn't be prepared to describe it right at the moment, but it was essentially, an increase in the sales tax across the three county area to support the expansion, very significant expansion of TTA and the gradual funding of building up the funds necessary to build a fixed guideway or light rail, or not necessarily literally light rail, but that type of public transportation system in the Triangle was basically what it was.
Well, maybe that's too specific, but I know that's something in particular that we heard a pretty good report on at that meeting.
They need to do something like that, I'll say. Let me just briefly, before I go to y'all, let me just briefly point out to y'all that I think we have at times, and we can certainly do it again, made a point of emphasizing to our delegation that there are some aspects of the league, particularly the league's, perhaps DJ Cog too, but particularly the league's agenda with respect to tort liability and some aspects of their position on public employee issues that we were not supportive of. So I think we can continue to have that language in there, but make a point of that sort of general language in there, but maybe make a point of you know, saying, noting the fact that we don't agree with them on all of the issues, particularly stuff in that area.
Maybe even if it's worded kind of similarly to last year, where it says support for except as described below. I mean, just to kind of say it there, that there are things below that kind of differ with the agenda.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Except as... Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. That's a good point.
I have a very specific thing I'd like to have on our list. As we all know, mental health reform was about as helpful as a plague. And we have a lot of our citizens who have been left in great pain because of that. And there's a lot of finger pointing going on in the administration over in Raleigh and whose fault it was and wasn't. And in the meantime, we have people suffering. Here in our area, in our mental health area, the group, the private group that was coming in to do better than OPC had, has pulled out after having made hundreds of thousands of dollars in profits. They've pulled out. And Freedom House is picking up a lot of the slack. Freedom House, for those of you who don't know, is a detox and recovery center for people with substance abuse problems. Freedom House is also now seeing more and more people who are dual diagnosed and some who are simply have psychiatric problems. And this has over doubled their staffing needs and their facility needs. So they are stretched to the limit, and they don't have enough money. And I know they have made a request to the legislatures, not for pork barrel money, but for straight up state money to help Freedom House do what it needs to be doing, and I'd like us to put down on our legislative agenda that we would like to support Freedom House's request for help, that this is not to be seen as charity, but as a public good. Our community cannot afford to do without these services. It shows up on our streets, shows up in our jails, shows up police issues. So I'm hoping that they're taking Freedom House's request strongly, and so let's really push for that.
Okay.
I had one also.
John, and then Randy.
Briefly, a couple of items. I would like to ask you for your support that we renew our commitment to support the Land for Tomorrow initiatives of that the General Assembly allocates $200 million for the next 5 years for land and water conservation. And second, I don't know how familiar you folks are with the 287G program that the General Assembly approved $750,000 the last session to support local charities to enforce immigration law. And I continue to hear reports throughout the state that this program is being abused, and would like to ask our delegation to look into it and review its effectiveness and progress on that issue.
My turn?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I had three items. Jackie mentioned the, in earnest, a commitment to the mentally ill and the and programs for folks who have these needs. It's an abomination what's occurred. Second, I had down the support for comprehensive water resources plan throughout the state, so that we're firmly committed as, you know, a unified legislation in what we're doing to offset droughts and the water use around the state.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Well, I think when we talk about how we just, you know, we're having trouble orchestrating just between the county, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and in terms of water stages, I just think in terms of the entire state, we need to be looking at what we do with water and how we.
But what does that mean specifically? Because I don't, you know, I think we do a good job.
I think
with water
we
compared to lots of other places,
right.
And I don't want to have some open-ended idea that might have the implication that our success would then be diluted with.
I want to strengthen what other areas are doing. I was very concerned, and I'm still concerned that, Durham and Raleigh came on board late, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of their conservation efforts, and they jettisoned earlier, and their sprawl is huge, and their water use is huge.
But what if we said support for statewide initiatives to encourage or require land use planning and conservation in regard to preservation of water supply?
That would be fine.
Because I don't want Easley to do for water what he's done for mental health.
Well, this is true.
And part of what Land for Tomorrow does is it has a strong component for water conservation, too.
Yes, it does. And the third item was to continue support for alternative energy and the use of alternative energy dependence on the fossil fuels, trying to reduce that dependency, and continued support for energy efficiency.
And can we include in that opposition to expansion of
absolutely
coal and nuclear power plants?
That's the point. Yes.
So it's turned out to be a typical Carrboro legislative agenda.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah, that's good. All right.
I will move all of the above.
Well, can I try to give a specific recitation of what I think we've included then?
Yeah. Okay.
Which is, I think it's basically that same agenda that we adopted last year. However, for item 10, it would be changed to read support for additional funding and legislation to help mentally ill people and support effective nonprofit service providers, particularly Freedom House.
Now, I'd like to make it a little stronger than that we support Freedom House's request for additional funding. So to have it
okay, so not particularly Freedom House, but specifically supporting Freedom House's request for state funding. I think they're hoping it'll be a bill. And then I would like to suggest that we remove item 11 about an increase in local hotel and motel occupancy taxes. I think we still have some footwork that we need to do before we're ready to
make that commitment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then number 16 we could drop because those charter amendments were, in fact, adopted last year.
Yeah. Mark, let's remember to add the charter amendment about the housing discrimination clause.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So we would have number 16 would be a request for a town charter amendment regarding
housing discrimination
and based on
sexual
orientation.
Supervision. 17, the repeal of North Carolina General Statute 9598. Mm-hmm. 18, support for the Land for Tomorrow funding initiative. 19, the town's opposition to state funding or participation in the federal 287G program.
It's kind of like to review its effectiveness and putting money into something we don't know. It's causing a lot of trouble. And I hear it's being abused.
Okay.
So
request the legislature look into the effectiveness of the program.
Exactly.
Number, and then I think I'm up to number 20 now, a comprehensive request for a comprehensive water resource conservation slash efficiency requirements and land use planning requirements. And number 20, a request for increased energy efficiency and conservation legislation and town's opposition to additional coal and nuclear power facilities being established. And then I think the last thing I meant to mention is number 14 on the list does mention something about campaign finance. I think we want to be more specific, though, than what it says now, which is support for proposed Carrboro campaign finance bill.
Right. And, and there's a bill number on that, which I think is House 488, but we can put the exact number.
See,
do those numbers carry forward?
I don't know.
I mean,
sometimes they do.
Are you the one that just mentioned, number 14, there was a bill that was drafted, and I guess it didn't pass.
It passed. I think it passed state senate, but it did not pass in the House.
I'll check on
that. Yeah, that was tabled to this session.
Okay. But there have been some further discussions with our House delegation about the situation. So there's optimism that there may
changes
be
in this bill. Is there anything I need to draft?
No, there's no change.
Okay.
Yeah, they've got it under committee.
The House members' questions have been answered, I think, is what it amounts to.
I've got the microphone here. Could I ask for one other piece of charter amendment is related to the presentation you had this evening. The illicit discharge ordinance sort of, in essence, requires you, or the obligation is that you do inspections to ensure that compliance exists. We don't really have the same kind of, there's no statutory authority provided to enter private property at reasonable times and circumstances to deal with that as there is in other statutory authorizations, such as for building inspection, minimum housing code inspection, and other matters. So I would propose to draft a charter amendment that just essentially would give you the authority when you adopt the ordinance to do what you're probably going to be required to do by the state, which is to provide for the inspection to enter private property, obviously not in the circumstances which required a search warrant, but I mean just to be able to, in essence, public areas, to do it what they need to do to enter private property so that they would have that authority, because right now we don't have it.
Okay. So that would be item 20.
And I will draft that.
Two or something.
And don't forget to, on items 1 and 2, to add the phrase, except where noted below.
Yes. Okay.
One more issue. We'd like to ask to request also support for consumer protection legislation that has to deal with predatory lending practices and the foreclosure crisis that we're facing. It's going to be some strengthening of the laws that we have, but a lot more needs to be done.
All right. I think I am positive that this board is in support of that motion.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the motion from Alderman Herrera, all of that stuff I just said. Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded that we make that our legislative agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. I think we have at least one important matter from the staff.
Yes, we do. I'll try to be as brief as possible, but in addition to myself, Anita Jones McNair and Captain Will Booker are here, and they perhaps will join in the conversation depending on how much detail we need to get into. But I guess about a week or so ago, Recreation Park staff was approached about the possibility of using town property for a rally and voter registration drive by the Barack Obama campaign. And they were particularly interested in the town commons property. We have an administrative policy in place that deals with the use of town commons as well as the Century Center. However, the scope and the nature of this particular event is such that I felt it would be appropriate to bring it to you all to seek some guidance. In essence, what they were requesting, and we asked them also to look at some other areas, town-owned property such as Anderson Park, They really would like to use town commons, and they would like to use it on the afternoon of Friday, May 2nd, preferably between the hours of 1 and 3, or if not that, between the hours of 2 and 5. They propose to have a couple of popular local bands to be here. I'm not sure what kind of speakers may be involved. As we understand, we don't believe Senator Obama would be here, but I guess that would be a possibility. Don't know that. Don't think that would be the case. There are several issues for us. It's during the workday. There's a lot of business going on in Town Hall. We have one-stop voting that day, which is part of why they want to do it that day, but it also means we've got more traffic in the building that day than we normally would have. Plus, you know, that's a normal business day for town staff. The bands, I'm assuming, would be, the request would be that they be amplified so the noise would likely carry beyond simply town commons. There's some specific language in the policy that addresses that. There also is a potential issue, or not potential, there will be an issue of parking and traffic. They estimate an attendance of 3,000 to 4,000 people for this event. We're a small town. That's a very significant impact on this little piece of property out here. So how we deal with the traffic and parking situation, whether we be having to look at closing certain streets, you know, advising the Emergency Operations Center with Orange County about rerouting, you know, EMS and fire trucks and those kind of things. I mentioned one-stop voting. I talked with the elections director today, and, you know, they indicated, you know, obviously they're interested in getting people to vote, and they would look to probably send in some additional staff if this turns out to happen on this afternoon, and they would be involved in enforcing the 50-foot perimeter from the entrance of Town Hall, which is state law. You can't be doing election things closer than 50 feet to the entrance to the polling place. Bathrooms, another issue. You know what the bathroom situation here is in Town Hall. It's barely adequate on farmers market days. We have several thousand people. We don't have adequate bathroom facilities to accommodate that level of people. So if this takes place, we would probably need to look at some sort of requirement for portable bathrooms on site. The potential for trash and other things associated with a large gathering like that, and the impact on our public works department. And I'll just remind you that Sunday, May 4th, is Carborough Day. So we're already bringing back a lot of folks in police, public works, recreation parks to work that event that's been planned for a long time. So I didn't feel comfortable in making a decision without getting some input from you all about how to handle this, and if the board is inclined to say yes, let's make it work, I would request that you give us some latitude to set some parameters to make it work as effectively as we can. I feel confident we will probably not only have to bring in off-duty Carborough police officers, but we also may need assistance from Chapel Hill if we got 4,000 people or more at Town Commons.
So, yes, sir. Do you know approximately what the largest event is we've had at Town Commons in terms of number of people?
This one predates me, but I think there was I'll probably get the name of the band wrong.
The Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Squirrel Nut Zippers, but that was not on a business. That was not on a work day. That was on after hours.
And I know we canceled July 4th because of crowds.
Well,
my other question is, would the fee structure for this event, would it cover all that additional town?
Well, what we would ask, I mean, the basic fee is $125 if it's over 4 hours, but there's also provision if we have to bring in police officers that they would be required to pay the cost
of that. And though it doesn't specifically say it, I would suggest going beyond that, because this is somewhat of an unusual event that if we have to bring other staff folks in beyond the normal workforce, that there ought to be a requirement that we get reimbursed for that. And Joel, Anita's been the one that has been the primary contact, but I think Joel's also had some conversations with a couple of the organizers. So if you have some specific questions about their conversations, please feel free.
I really want us to support this. I think it's good for the town to have that kind of statewide, nationwide visibility. I remember when the zippers came, when the scroll-knot zippers came, and we fretted and we were real concerned, and we didn't even have to pick up much trash. They because we made it real clear that there would be no drinking and that we wanted people to throw away their trash. It was this really orderly crowd. It went great. And that was real good for us. And it's what this space, you know, and granted Obama's not quite as popular as the zippers, but I think it's still there. I think it's a little too bad that they're not interested in using Wilson Park. Maybe the Edwards could host it out. They got a lot of space even inside. They could put all those people, I think, probably. But I think it's the kind of thing that we need to figure out a way to make it work and to grant the request.
I wanted to ask Anita whether or not the folks who contacted you had a little more flexibility in terms of the time so that it didn't so much overlap, workday needs here.
We asked that if they could start later in the afternoon, 4 or 5 o'clock, because what we think would be a significant impact on trying to do business here at Town Hall. And from their perspective, and it makes a lot of sense to me, they want to be able to get as many new folks registered as possible and step up from Town Commons into this room, mm-hmm. to be able to do the one-stop voting, mm-hmm. that very day. So if it's after hours, the one-stop voting won't be in place, and so they lose some of, I guess, the effectiveness of what they hope to accomplish in those few hours. Is that fair, Anita?
Is this the Chapel Hill campaign office you all been?
This the person that that you talked with, Anita, was out of Chicago.
Maybe they are currently stationed at that point. I'm not certain.
We don't know if the Chapel Hill office is even aware of this or not.
I'm sorry, Lydia.
When I was at Central, I remember Clinton and Gore came through, and it was like this on campus. It was, I mean, I'm not saying Obama's going to be here, but I'm just saying this idea of a special event thrown in the middle of a workday when it's not a normal place where you have a special activity. Just a couple of thoughts that are kind of coming to me. One is, whether we use it very often or not, clearly we need to have a protocol for an event above and beyond just your average four-hour reservation. And that may exist, although I'm not sure, and I want to ask a question about that, because, you know, this is a huge special event. And my question kind of is, and this is just me not knowing since I'm new on the board, you know, how does this differ from how we approve road races, for example? I mean, this is a big special event. It's going to affect the town and money, indirect costs, and so on. Is this something that perhaps in the future is because it's of such a magnitude, it should be kind of categorized a little differently than just your average small special event? So that's one question. And the second one is, I think we need to be clear that whatever we do with this event, it may or may not set a precedent, but would we be jumping on this if it were another group or another candidate or another circumstance? You know, so we just kind of need to think of it in terms of, if we allow this, then how do we deny something else or allow something else?
To the first question, we don't really have anything. We've already talked about the fact that this has pointed out a shortcoming for those road races and things. There are specific requirements in the town code. This is an administrative policy, and it was really designed for the smaller events that routinely happen out here. And then we have, you know, special language for the farmer's market and those kinds of things. But the existing policy did not envision a 4,000-person event at Town Commons, whatever the purpose of the event happened to be.
That the existing policy or the existing ordinance covers street events. That's right. So there's a policy and a program and a protocol on the public hearing because that's involved the closing of a street. That doesn't apply to this.
This
will require.
Though we may have to look at closing streets. I mean, this is we're giving you the best information we have, but this I don't know how fully baked. You know,
How did they come up with a number like 4,000? I mean, Dan mentioned, you know, July 4th, which is really big, or Carver Day, which is really big, or the music festival. How did they ballpark that number?
That's what the organizers, I think, told Captain Booker. The original number was 1,000 to 2,000, and then it grew to 3,000 to 4,000. It started with one band, then it grew to two bands.
So if
the word got out that, hey, maybe there's a chance that Senator Obama would be here, well, they're going to put that out there because they'd be, you know what I mean?
No, he's going to be in Greenville Thursday, so the likelihood of coming back.
This is May 2nd.
So he's just going to stay at John's house, right? But anyway, give us a perspective.
Maybe
so, July 4th is about how many people?
Joel, do you know, or Anita? I don't know.
About 5,000 or 6,000 people, but they're going. It's a little different.
It's staggered,
they're going
right?
Going and coming, right? And they're in different parts of the
right.
of the town. See,
right.
This would be solely based here.
Right. I got it, but I just want to get a reference
a
point.
And then we've got, like I said, an all-day event.
Yeah.
So people are going and coming in.
Right.
I mean, we don't really know, but I think, you know, Captain Booker's been here for a long time and worked a lot of events. And I think, Joel, it was your feeling that it easily could be that amount, if not more.
Correct. I think it will sort of grow.
I mean, it's a Friday afternoon. The focus is on students. I don't know, you know, how many UNC students have late afternoon Friday classes and
they should be done
by
they're
planning on it. Planning
yeah.
Do we know who the proposed bands are?
Well, we suggested that.
Do we know who the proposed bands are?
They mentioned the names.
I apologize. They told me and I don't.
That don't mean anything
y'all
to
aren't
you,
hip
so
enough. All right. Anyway.
We're too old.
I probably wouldn't even recognize them anyway, but I'm just curious. Okay.
So, and you also mentioned, Steve, something, you know, latitude to set parameters. What, give me an idea what you think.
Well, to be able to, for one thing, to say, you know, if any extra cost we incur, it's on you. Maybe even some sort of deposit for cleanup. You know, that we don't really have a provision in place to really do that, but we've got no enforcement mechanism for cleanup. If we wanted to try to tone down the noise, would be to require that any kind of music be acoustic or otherwise, that it not be amplified. I mean, there is a provision that says that the whatever the form of communication is supposed to be limited to the parameters of Town Commons. Well, if there's a rock band out there, we're going to be hearing it, I'm guessing, in our offices on Friday afternoon. And I love rock and roll, so it's not going to really bother me, but it might bother some folks in the community, might bother some other folks who are working here. Also, if we do have to look at doing something with the streets, you know, Mike, I don't know what that might involve because, I mean, there is a process, a public hearing process to go through. But, I mean, if we have several thousand people here all wanting to drive their cars in here, I mean, we've got absolute gridlock.
You know what? I'd like you to go back and look at the records and the minutes from when the Scrawnut Zippers came here because that was really orderly. And people were asked to walk here. And they were told places they could park and the outlying parking areas. And word went out, don't drive, walk. And that happened. And I think, you remember that, Mark? People, and there wasn't much trash left when they left, because
it was a lot better than the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
The other suggestion
I don't mean the music.
Was to ask them to perhaps work with Chapel Hill Transit to take advantage of park and ride and try to limit the number of cars actually coming into downtown. And we've also talked about perhaps taking our Weaver Street lot and asking our town employees to park at that lot and reserve it that afternoon so that we don't get our folks boxed in here and we don't take up all the parking right here on site. That's so the kind
still,
of latitude.
You still need to secure parking for the voting and
yeah, we'll need that. To do yeah, we will need
and
to
and
do,
access
do,
in and out
to do yeah. something and you know that I mean that's another at least concern, and that is for the folks who simply want to come here that day and vote and are not interested in participating in a rally. It's an impediment to them getting in and out of here.
Yeah.
It won't be easy.
What time does early voting end? It doesn't. They don't go all the way to 5.
5,
do they?
Yeah.
4:30.
No, they end at 4:30 or something.
I can't remember, Mark, but okay. it's 4:30 or 5.
And this is 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock?
That's the ideal.
Or 2 to 5.
I think the reality is we're talking about all afternoon on May 2nd because it starts at 1. There's not some magic button that we're going to push that says at 3 o'clock everybody's suddenly gone.
We'll break up that crap. It's 3.
So how do we...
And so there would need to be clean up in time for the farmer's market the next morning.
Right.
And they're doing the 30th anniversary farmer's market thing that day.
I guess it's
that
day.
On the 3rd, yeah.
Right. So. Okay.
And a really, really free market. That's the first Tuesday, first Saturday of the month, so we've got that afternoon, and then...
And Carver Day is on Sunday.
It's a blitz. So. How do we discuss Lydia's question, though?
I want to say this. I guess I do... That's sort of my reservation about all of this, is trying to, divorce my feelings about the candidate from the question of the overall request. Because I would need to feel confident that we would treat other candidates who are requesting to do something. I don't know how John McCain would possibly get 4,000 people onto the town commons in Carrboro, but if that were his goal, would we grant him the permission to do it to attempt to do it? That's where I feel a little bit uncomfortable, but I'm willing to try this event. I want to say though that I think. Depending on how it goes, it may be a matter of our identifying in the follow-up to this event what kind of new policies are needed. And I would hold out the possibility that, the new policy that's needed is we're not doing that again, really depending on – or not on a weekday, not when we're trying to also conduct business at town hall. That's my big reservation. So I don't know. I guess I'm willing to make a try of it and commit to the notion that if others want to do something similar, that we're gonna exercise our policies similarly in the future. But also recognize that depending on how this goes, the policy in the future might in fact be entirely different, mm-hmm. not because of who's requesting it, but because of how our experience goes with this event.
Right.
And
so
are you including the latitude Steve's requesting then in terms of taking care of the needs of the town?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think John
was ready to make a motion.
Is ready to make a motion that'll include that.
Great.
So,
okay.
I move that we authorize our town manager to deal with this event and use his best judgment as he always had. And it's going to be a learning experience, but I think it's worth trying. It's about civic participation. It's what Carrboro stands for. And seems to be, you will set the parameters and negotiate with them. I believe, what's in the best interest of the town.
I'll second that.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Are there, very briefly, any items
from board members?
Just really briefly, reminder to everyone, I think a week from Thursday is the advisory board's dinner. It's all try to be there if we can.
Thank you.
Yes.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to adjourn. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously.